Good morning, everyone. At this time each weekday morning, the National Broadcasting Company joins its networks to bring you the news at home and abroad. The war news on this, the 544th day of conflict, is reported by our staffs in England and Germany. Later, Earl Godwin gives you the news in Washington. But first, reports from overseas. Go ahead, London.
This is John McBain in London. Single German raiders last night made scattered attacks on various parts of Britain. London had two raid alarms, but only a few districts reported bombs. The hardest raid of the night was made on a northeast coast town, where hundreds of incendiary bombs and many high explosives were dropped. Today's communique mentions other raids on points near the east coast. Damage and casualties are said to have been slight. British bombers again hammered the invasion ports of Calais and Boulogne last night. Watchers on the English coast could see the flashes of anti-aircraft fire as the German guns hunted for the British planes. Bad weather stopped any other British attacks on the continent. Before dawn today, the German long-range guns in France began firing at the Dover area. British guns answered. A mist hung over the channel today and visibility was cut down to about 2 miles. Authoritative circles in London today branded as untrue the Japanese claim that Britain had turned down proposals by Japan regarding the Pacific and the Far East. It was pointed out here that neither Britain nor Japan made any proposals and that the conversations merely consisted of an exchange of views. In these conversations, Britain, without making any direct or implied threat, pointed out the consequences that would arise if Japan were to make any intervention toward the south. Both in the talks with the Japanese ambassador in London and those between the British ambassadors, Sir Robert Craigie and Mr. Matsuoka in Tokyo, the British say they have taken every step to draw attention to what those consequences might be. To put it in plain and undiplomatic language, the British are carrying no chip on their shoulders, but they told the Japanese that if they try to jump on the Dutch East Indies or French Indochina, they can expect plenty of trouble in a hurry. Informed quarters in London take an optimistic view of the statement by Monsieur Sarıcıoğlu, the Turkish foreign minister, that Turkey will go to war if necessary to stand by her pacts. The statement is regarded in London as a valuable reaffirmation of Turkey's resolve to carry out her treaty obligations. It is noted here that at the time the Turkish-Bulgarian pact was announced, attention was called to the clause stressing Turkey's loyalty to her agreements and readiness to abide by her commitments to Britain. British official circles have never doubted that Turkey would abide by her agreements, and they hope the other Balkan countries will study Turkey's stand. There is great interest in London as to what the reaction of the other Balkan governments will be. There is no news of the start of the German entry into Bulgaria, and it's still believed in Britain that it's just a question of waiting, as a British spokesman put it, until the Germans press the button. Reports from Washington that the British and American governments are planning a new series of military and diplomatic moves that will bring them into closer collaboration are not confirmed here. Official circles point out that the relations between the two countries have been clearly stated in speeches by President Roosevelt, Mr. Churchill, and Mr. Hull, and there seems to be no reason to add anything to the collaboration between the two countries as they have stated it. With the invasion of Bulgaria expected hourly in London, the position of Russia in the Balkan tangle still remains obscure. Soviet sources here are noncommittal, and it may very well be that Stalin is keeping his decisions to himself. There is little doubt that Russia would prefer not to see the Germans in Bulgaria. On the other hand, Soviet diplomats are emphatic about Russia's desire to keep out of the war. And reading between the lines, it seems fairly certain that Russia won't actively oppose a German entry into Bulgaria. The fact that Germany has troops massed all along the frontier with Russia, a gesture that Russia has reciprocated, is a good indication that neither country trusts the other very much. But the Soviets haven't any special reason to trust Britain either. The semi-official Russian denial that the Turco-Bulgarian pact was made with her knowledge and approval is probably another indication that Russia wants to emphasize that whatever happens in the Balkans is none of her affair. But whether Russia can afford to keep up an attitude of isolation is another thing. As Germany moves eastward, she comes more and more into conflict with interests that every Russian government, whether czarist or communist, has regarded as vital. If Germany ends up by attacking Turkey, she will threaten Russia's entrance into the Mediterranean, and it's difficult to see the Russians staying isolationist under such conditions, unless they are more in awe of the German army than there is any reason to believe at the moment. However, for the present, Russia may be expected to avoid open conflict with Germany and to continue to play her diplomatic cards for all they're worth to get her share of whatever spoils there may be. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And that's the news from England this morning. And now overseas again, over the British Isles, the English Channel, Britain's eastern frontier, and the Nazi-occupied Low Countries, for a report from our staff in Germany. Go ahead, Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Theodor Knaut speaking from Berlin. Adolf Hitler is going to speak this afternoon at 5 o'clock, Berlin summer time. It has just been announced. The occasion for the address is the anniversary of the founding of the National Socialist Party in 1920, February 24th having been the day on which his party program was announced, the program to which Hitler has adhered for 21 years and on the basis of which he has gone so far. Following as it does the speech which Mussolini made in Rome yesterday, it will be interesting to see what the other Axis chief will have to say to his people and to the world, and whether any further light will be thrown on the future plans of the two Allied powers and their third partner, Japan. There are so many points at which they can begin to strike, in the Balkans, in the Mediterranean, on England itself, and in the Far East, and so many ways in which, in combination, they can launch their blows to end the war. And we have been waiting so long for the great offensive to start that here, as surely is the case everywhere else too, people's nerves are somewhat stretched. And the war on nerves is not to be overlooked in considering the moves that have recently been made on the chessboard of the war. Yesterday, both the Deutsche Allgemeine Zeitung and the Frankfurter Zeitung devoted a large part of the front pages of their Sunday editions to accounts of the Japanese Navy, comparing it particularly with that of the United States. The new Japanese battleships of 45,000 tons each, about which there has been so much mystery, are now supposed to be ready, and in their armament and defensive armor are said to be superior to anything that America has afloat. And besides, the Japanese are supposed to have the advantage of being able to concentrate their fleets, while both the navies of the United States and of Great Britain are bound to be more or less scattered, which offsets the numerical advantage they have over the Japanese. Someday, and I dare say soon, we will be able to connect up such incidents as the simultaneous publication of such articles in leading papers, and yesterday's Mussolini speech, and today's speech by Adolf Hitler, and the recent agreement between Bulgaria and Turkey, and the surprising forecast of Germany's plans for ending the war that appeared in the German news agency last week, and fit them into the picture of setting the stage for the great war drives that are expected to start soon. And we will know what their effect was on the war of nerves in heartening the spirits of the Axis peoples and depressing those of the British. But at the moment, we are still waiting for the show to begin, and to say that we are all agog is to put it mildly. Speaking of the Bulgarian agreement with Turkey, the Russian official news agency TASS denies a report coming from Switzerland that Russia took part in the negotiations there. And regarding Japan, it is said in official quarters that the mediation in the dispute between Siam and French Indochina is continuing. The armistice that ended last Friday, we hear from newspaper reports, has been extended until tomorrow. The visit of Ambassador Oshima to Fushel to call on Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop there is taken here as a sign of the especially hearty friendship between the two nations and between the two men personally. As for the Balkans, nothing is known here of demonstrations in Bulgaria, for which there is said to be no occasion, and a possible visit by Mr. Eden to Sofia and Belgrade is discounted. The technical difficulties in the way of such a trip are said to be considerable. The German communique reports some submarine sinkings. One U-boat is credited with four ships, aggregating 33,000 tons, and another with two for a total of 7,000 tons. Otherwise, there is no military news of importance today. A British raid on Wilhelmshaven is made little of, as most of the bombs dropped in the mud flats, it is said, and the large fire that the British report is said to have been in a farmhouse, which it is true was destroyed. This is Theodor Knauth speaking from Berlin and returning you to NBC.
Next, Earl Godwin with the early morning reports from our newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. Our long-suffering and rather generous State Department has been doing its best to help Russian diplomacy maintain what the diplomats call a balanced foreign policy. That is, Russia does not want, it says it does not want, to show partiality to any one country in its treaties and so forth, at least in the externals. And so they were very glad to get from our State Department the concession of lifting that moral embargo on airplanes from here to Russia. That occurred about a month ago, and it was, of course, merely a gesture because there are no airplanes for Russia. There are no airplanes to spare for anybody except Great Britain. But the score was chalked up diplomatically as one for Russia, and the career boys were happy. However, the Dyes Committee on Capitol Hill emitted a roar of displeasure and went to work to show that come what may, and no matter what the promises have been, Russia, as the Dyes Committee claims, is still by and large a purchasing agent for Berlin. The Dyes Committee made so much of a fuss about it that the matter reached as far as the British Parliament, where there was a debate, and the new British ambassador, as one of his very first errands, took up the matter with our own State Department, which today, I'm told, will go a step further and try to find out just what's behind the recent figures, their Department of Commerce figures, which have been used by myself and other Washington newspaper correspondents and commentators and the Dyes Committee to indicate that since Germany started the war, Russia has suddenly increased her purchases of stuff that she grows and makes herself, but which Germany needs. Cotton, wheat, copper, oil well machinery are the main items. Today, if the appointment book is correct, Sumner Wells, Undersecretary of State, and the Russian ambassador, Mr. Omansky, will have a heart-to-heart talk, and it is assumed here, believed at least, that this matter of American goods leaking through Russia to Germany, if that's true, will be discussed. There's no doubt about the figures in the Department of Commerce indicating that there has been a tremendous bulge in certain American exports to Russia since the German advance on the democracies started. This government has no idea of aiding Germany that way, but Undersecretary of State Wells indicates he has to have this allegation proved to him, that he must know for sure that America is playing the game for Germany via Russia before anything can be done about it. And what can be done about it is that we simply stop exporting certain shipments by the license method. The inquiry into the facts on strikes in defense industry continues today before the Judiciary Committee of the House, headed by the veteran Hatton Sumners of Texas as chairman. That committee may adopt a policy of meeting so frequently and for so long a time for a month to come that strikes in defense industry may die away simply because of adverse publicity. You know, that hearing draws a large crowd every time the committee meets. But the biggest show in Washington is the debate on the Leis-Len bill, which has a distinction now of putting on longer speeches than almost any debate in years. We are told that when Senator Bert Wheeler of Montana starts to speak, he will consume 2 Senate days on his attack on the Leis-Len measure. However, that bill can be passed by the Senate this week if they hurry up, but the question is how much will the Senate change the measure? The opponents say they have enough votes to force incorporation of an amendment which would prevent American troops from being sent abroad. The administration spokesmen do not think the proposed clause will be written into the bill. And Earl Godwin says goodbye. That's the news from Washington at this time.
And that's the news from at home and abroad. For reports of further developments of world interest, listen to the many regular news summaries broadcast daily by this station. And this is the National Broadcasting Company.